trainer with the NYU AIDS Mental Hygiene Project. She's going to talk to us about issues of lesbians and sexuality among adolescents. We have, seated next to her, Bonnie Ledbetter, who's an associate professor of developmental psychology at Yale University. She's going to talk some about the messages that we send to teenagers about their sexuality, primarily through the media and in other places. And then we have Catherine Dossimer, who is a consulting psychologist at Columbia University Mental Health Service and author of Female Adolescents. She's going to share with us her observations about the trends in attitudes and problems associated with sexuality over the past 15 years or so based on her practice as a clinician. And then finally, I'm going to bring up the rear and talk a little bit about issues from sort of an economist's perspective about some of the consequences of teenage sexuality, primarily issues surrounding teenage motherhood. So I think we've covered quite a range of topics here. We're going to start with Eileen, and I'll mute you.
Thank you. My name is Eileen. I'm an alcoholic and a lesbian. And I have to make some corrections. First of all, I'm not the director of the Swingers Alcoholic Treatment Center. I'm the nursing clinical coordinator.
They wish you were.
I'm also not an adjunct professor at the NYU School of Nursing. I'm an adjunct professor at the Columbia University School of Nursing. But I am a trainer with the NYU AIDS And I'm also not going to be talking about lesbians and adolescents. When I was approached to do this panel, they got me kind of an afterthought. They tried to get someone from the Hedgehog Institute, but those people have no problems to attend today. So they called me, and I said, look, I'm not an academic. What do you want me to do? I don't know how useful I'll be to this panel. And she said, well, tell your own story. So I said, okay, if that will do, I'll tell you my own story. I'm 47 years old. And I've been sober for about 19 and a half years. I got sober right before my 28th birthday. And 2 weeks after I got sober, I knew that I was attracted to women. And it took me 5 years from that point before I came out. And I was 5 years very slow, and at times very painful process. And I'll get back to that in a couple of minutes. I should also give you some background. I grew up in California to white, parents who also were very liberal, still are, and grew up in the 1960s in the San Francisco Bay Area. I knew from an early age that I was different, in that I was not really interested in a lot of things that girls were interested in those days, or as young children, I was not interested in dolls or playing house. I was much more interested in Rin Tin Tin and had always had a very, very strong adventurous streak and had always wanted to travel. That was really my main goal in life. I should also tell you that my brother was gay, and I knew that my brother was gay when I was very young, when I was about 13, even though he did not come out to my parents until much later on. And actually, they didn't officially come out to them until and because of his tortured relationship with my father, I think that if I had known of any inclination that I had, that I was going to keep them totally squelched, really squelched on a subconscious level, because I decided on some level that I wanted to be a perfect child. You know, my brother didn't get along with my father, and I couldn't bear to hear their fights, how they communicated or did not communicate with each other. And so I was pretty determined to be perfect. I know that I had fantasies about women when I was 13 and 14. I don't think property of a lot of people. My brother knew the Grateful Dead before they actually came to Grateful Dead. And Jerry Garcia used to come and perform at our house. And I went to school with Bob here at the Grateful Dead and actually went on a date taught me guitar lessons, and I think I was the only member of the flower generation that wasn't a participant. You know, I was simply not a participant. I felt, as I said, incredibly repressed, and it was very isolating existence that I had. And my alcoholism, I think, flowered during this time, and some drugs, although, as I said, I never got into the acid. And I think that was a way for me to deal with my inability to deal with my feelings. I went to the University of Oregon. I graduated, came back down to California, lived in Europe for a period of time, went to nursing school, and my addiction really took off when I was in nursing school. I got sober, as I said, right before my 28th birthday. Two weeks after I got sober, I went to a 12-step meeting where there were a lot of lesbians. It was not touted as a lesbian meeting. But I knew that I felt at home with the people at that meeting. And I began to have fantasies about them. And it was a very liberating experience for me because, in a way, I was finally getting in touch with my own truth. But it also horrified me because, as I said, I wanted to be the perfect child. And being a lesbian and my brother being gay was not in it. One of my childhood fantasies had been to go to Africa to work in the jungle at a missionary hospital. And when Peace Corps was developed, it was my dreams joined Peace Corps. And so 2 years after I got sober, with all of this sexuality beginning to kind of bud, I left to go and work in West Africa at a missionary hospital in Trouble. Now you have to kind of picture this because most Peace Corps volunteers smoke dope, drink, and have sex. That's what they do. And here I was leaving for Africa, having all of these feelings that were totally mixed up in my head, not having and not drinking and using. So you can see what a setup that was for me to really, in a way, hit sort of the bottom. I had had sexual relationships, by the way, with men. And I had sex with my boyfriend and with other men as well. Not to the extent that a lot of my peers had, but it wasn't as if I was totally. But I had never really had a fully satisfying emotion. Anyway, I was in the Peace Corps, and I didn't dare talk about any of this with anyone. No one knew I was an alcoholic, and no one knew that I was in the closet. And by this time, I knew that I was certainly convinced that I was dead. And I also knew during that two-year period of time that I was in this country in this country that if I didn't address this, I was going to rapidly reach emotional dead end. I had really reached some sort of limit in my own ability to repress everything that was going on. And that either I had to kind of jump into the fray or that nothing much else was going to happen in my life. And there was a Peace Corps volunteer named Harry who I liked a lot. And one day, one weekend, he and I planned to spend together. And we were going to go on his motorcycle the next morning to Liberia. Market from Sierra Leone, the country that I was in. And I went up there to have dinner and I was going to spend the night with him the next morning. And after dinner, he asked me if I wanted to sleep with him. He said, "Do you like me?" And I said, "No." Without even pausing. And so I only say this to kind of underscore this dead end that I had arrived at. A year later, I had left the Peace Corps and I had traveled. I started a trip that was the last 6 months. I went to the East Africa and Kenya. And I was staying in the Rift Valley in Kenya, in an area of the planet that could all be described as I was actually housed in the Rift Valley for 2 weeks, and there were giraffes and monkeys and Maasai warriors who had come to the house where I was staying and bring me milk in the morning. And I was reading a book by a woman named Sarah Bates called Loose Change, which was published, I think, in the early 70s. And it was a book about Berkeley during the 1960s. And in this book, there was a description of a relationship that a woman has with another woman. And I remember reading this book. I was outside in the Rift Valley, you know, giraffes walking by and the Maasai warriors and everything else. I mean, you couldn't imagine a greater paradise than this, thinking, I want to get home. You know, I want to jump into this. I don't want to be the person I've been all my life anymore. And you know how you see those pictures of animals who've been tranquilized, and after, and then they're given an antidote, and the animal begins to wake up. Well, that's how I felt. You know, I felt like I was beginning to wake up. Well, to make a long story very short, I came back to this country, and actually Harry, the guy who originally asked me into his room, he and I had an affair when I came back to this country, and he was a wonderful lover, and it was really certainly part of my awakening, although I knew that when I was with him, I was not emotionally attracted. I mean, I loved him, but I was not attracted to him. And a year later, and I put myself in positions where I would be with him, and a year later, I finally slept with the woman. And I remember being with her that night and feeling as if I'm coming home. You know, this is what I had been looking for my whole life. And I remember thinking, while I was making love, you know, how can something that feels this good be so bad? I mean, it just did not make any sense to me at all. And somehow I completely blossomed. You know, here all this repressed sexual energy that I had been experiencing for years. It was like this incredible flowering, and it was wonderful, and I completely celebrated my sexuality afterward. And it has been a wonderful growth into my fifth decade. After I had been out for about a year, I met a woman named Helen, and she and I lived together for 5 years, and it was a wonderful relationship, and I certainly considered myself married to her, and my mother accepted her as my partner. I had never come out to my father because I was terrified of his response to me, given his response to my brother. And after my brother died, I finally did come out to my father, and he was wonderful. Helen and I did break up, which was a shattering experience. And one of the things that I think is difficult is that my mother, even though she was accepting, did not really, I think, fully understand that as far as I was concerned, I was going through a divorce. It took a long period of time for me to get involved seriously again. And I remember thinking last year, or actually a couple of years ago, looking at all these wedding rings when I was on the subway, thinking, I can do that. You know, I've never obviously been married, I've never had children. But looking at all these wedding rings, I thought, you know, there's nothing wrong with me, I can do this. And so a year ago, actually a year ago, next weekend, I met my current lover, and we were planning it. Or even thinking about really doing it up big and going and registering it at Tiffany. And I'm incredibly happy. You know, because this is such a short period of time, I think I kind of glossed over that 5-year period where I was not able to talk about this with anybody. And I think all of us, or at least most of the people I'm talking to that come out, it's not an easy, simple process. And I can talk about it very glibly, and I can, come out to all of you without any sense of shame. And yet during that 5-year period, it was very, I did feel shame about my sexuality. So I know that I take that far too much, and I apologize, and thank you very much.
mod and you can put up a new one.
Excuse me, I guess I have to get back here.
I'm not going to use that because I don't think I have.
Looking good, feeling shaped, Brianna from Prescriptions for Sexual Attractiveness. In some ways, the story of coming out is a story of coming out for all girls. And I think in some ways, the struggle is equally heroic for all girls. And I think our role as women and as educators of young women is to really try to understand why it becomes so difficult so that at the age of 28, we're beginning to discover your sexuality. I, in my own research, study adolescent women. Very little further and further in the street, these lips become bigger and bigger and bigger until that's you, what you believe anyone, everyone is seeing about you. And the sort of idea of looking good and feeling shame. And the reception that she gives as shaming, that boy, you're stupid for doing that stuff anyway. I think these messages are really delivered in these magazines in a big way.
Oh, wait. That must be an extension.
Anyway, in Sassy, you learn all about how to be a girl and how to be a sexual girl. Sassy's a slightly older version of the teen, I think probably 14. Teen is like a millennial audience. But the things that it tells you is, you know, when to say yes to sex, how my life is a mess, how to talk to boys, eat, don't pig out, summer hot, summer look to show some skin, make them look twice, your love to take to show the other one, look, yeah, the other one. Your love to take. You can get a lot about how to find your man or catch your man from astrology, that's how to talk to a guy. And in this one, particularly interesting, questions you're too embarrassed to ask. We've got the answers. And I just want you to flip really quickly through the 50 questions that are related to. These are the questions that you're too embarrassed to ask. They're questions that are all related to puberty. What body changes happen during puberty? And you see in these questions some of Michelle Kline's argument, what's the period, when did your period begin, how do you know it started, why does menstruation occur? It turns out fairly biological. And then there's a lot of questions about what's normal and what it's going to do to you. How can I use the pain? Why are they so regular? What's premenstrual syndrome? You become victims of these periods very quickly. Should I exercise? Should I use tampons? Questions you're too embarrassed to ask. And this being embarrassed to ask these questions is really heavily in this literature. My discharge is too thick. What's a yeast infection? We become disease oriented. What causes yeast infection? That's true, too. I mean, you never really get disease. What is puberty again? My general area, there seems to be excess skin. It's not the same on both sides. Am I normal?
What age group is this geared to?
This is 11. This is sort of 11 to 13. When does it occur? My breasts are very small and I do. My nipples don't look like the ones I've seen in the magazine. You can skip a few, you're getting active. You can do like up to 50, you can do that. I have stretch marks. Will I lose my virginity if I use a tampon? How to use a tampon? Oh. And in fact, I believe that these are questions that 11, 12, 15-year-olds are asked, that these are concerns about being normal, that these are the kinds of things that people, that young people think about when they think about sexuality. There's a great PBS Children's Television Network thing, what kids want to know about sex. Is there an orientation? These are kids' questions, I think are true. This was a radical release that really dealt with things like orgasms and menstruation and masturbation, actually, on this tape. So it had great press, but I wish that I had enough time to show it to you, but some of the things that the facilitator does in terms of demonstrating how embarrassing it should be to ask these questions, or how embarrassed you should be about the changes in your body. Real sense of you know, things going wrong here, but not really knowing quite how to control them. A lot of the education around, if you can just push that way up, a lot of the education around using pads have to do with not only keeping clean and, you know, not having any leaks or accidents, but around secrecy, around, you know, don't let anybody know this about you. Although your girlfriend may be really excited the first time you menstruate, they don't want to know about it ever again. And the boys in your class do not want to know. And neither do your parents. So, you know, you have to do a lot of things to get noticed, true, but wearing a pad shouldn't be one of them. You really don't want to, you know, have any embarrassing accidents, it says in the bottom. You don't want to be worrying about embarrassing accidents. So there's a certain delivery, I think, that, you know, a sort of undercurrent in some of these messages that our bodies are out of control, that they can get diseases, that it's something you can't know too much about. That you can have difficulties hiding these surprises, your surprising periods, that people really shouldn't know that this is a secret about you. The sort of emphasis on small breasts, again, you know, disguising your sexuality, disguising yourself. And we really are teaching girls in a very, I think, assertive way that they are not in control of their lives, that anything bad might happen to them, and that we really do not see them as the agents of their sexuality. The take-home messages, and I have one more slide after this I'd like you to think about, are more questions. Is the possibility of controlling our bodies, our appearance, our sexuality, undermined by confusing messages about the consequences of our acting, or of our inaction, of our choice to do it or not to do it, or to use tampons, not to use tampons. If you take charge of your appearance, is your self-statement subject to ridicule or silent attack? So if you put on that lipstick, you know, will you arrive in your office with your lips lifted like that? If you do nothing, at least you don't have to be responsible for it, or do you, given on a current round, you know, teen mothers, belief that teen mothers are the ones who's responsible for the products of their. And then I just want to give you one. This is an ad that appeared four times in these two magazines. And I'm not going to do anything about it. Really need to see it. It's the girl is, this is Violence is the Voice of the Inner Heart. This young woman is Courtney. And she's advertising, and push it way up to the top, no excuses clothes. And if you just sort of zing in on here, I mean, I would like to know what you think is the message. Can you just open the other one too? There are four versions of the same thing occurring in each of these things. Just pull that one down a little bit. Bring it right down to the bottom. Okay. And this is the message. Violence is the voice of the I'm interested in what you are hearing. I don't know if we're allowed to do this. We should hold on. Check out. You can tell me. What are they selling? What are the messages here? If you're confused.
In the previous picture, it looks like he or she is about to get undressed, but the issue is that she's going to do it herself when there's going to be violence and getting her undressed. And Happy has the jeans these days, it's selling sex, not jeans. And half the time, the women look like they've just been raped and thoroughly enjoyed it.
I think there's something about violence and rape, and, you know, when you associate all these things, that's what people talk about with this, and it's not quite clear what she thinks about on the paper.
I was just going to say that, because I've actually, you know, that, you know, like, right now there's this whole thing about being PC about youth violence, so they, like, you know, they put violence as the voice of an ignorant heart, but yet nobody really pays attention to that. Everyone's looking at the girl, you know, who's with her pants open, you know, so it's
what does it mean, violence as the voice of an ignorant
heart?
You're not too old.
Well, see, but my first reaction to it was when I saw the ad, is that, you know, they were trying to make a statement about youth violence, you know, and that violence is something wrong, and, you know, to try to put, you know, yeah, but then it just doesn't make sense to me. Why put that, it's just kind of like this, like, little label that they decided to stick on to be PC. You know, when obviously they all care about just selling the genes and selling the genes through sex.
But I think that that there is a message here, and it is going to a few previously tons of kids. And we do have this sort of war about women and boys and this sort of, you know, notion about violence and, you know, you think of something about heart and love and, you know, there's something happening here that does deliver a message, even if you just read violence, voice and heart, hey, no excuse. You know, we have the opportunity to think about it, but, you know, what it means, what it's intended to be.
A lot of times the media link sex and violence. So by saying violence is the voice of the ignorant heart, they're saying that the ignorant heart is sexuality has to do with violence. And they're trying to say that the dumb has nothing to do with violence. In other words, making sex look more gentle or more over
meeting, I thought, well, okay, this is the scholar and the feminist, you know, Roman numeral 21, I'm thinking about the past 20 or 30 years, actually. About 20 or 25 years of my own clinical experience. And the first thing that I want to say, looking back over this astonishing period of history that we lived through, is in obvious ways how much things have changed. I think primarily in the lives of relatively privileged women, but and it is certainly the case that in terms of members of professional schools, occupations, somewhat more open to the certainly glass ceilings within the realm. The inclusion of women writers in the college curricula, that sort of thing. Particularly the participation of women in sports, I think is of enormous importance. And as a measure of how much things have changed in that, an example close to home is that everybody knows about the events surrounding the building of the Columbia Gym across the street, and nearly brought the university and the world to a standstill, as you know. Sure, I'd be glad to. When there was a proposal to build a gymnasium for Columbia, there was a lot of controversy about whether that gym should be accessible only to members of Columbia's students and faculty or to the community in which it's located. And there was passions or high blood we shared. The police were called. Things happened here that really continued to reverberate for a long time after. At any rate, as you know, that gym was built. But I've never heard anybody comment on this, that when it was finally built, there were no lockers for women. When my friend Roberta Campbell and I went to play squash, we had to go to the visiting team's locker rooms in the sub basement. So some things have changed, really. And more directly on our subject of sexuality, the legalization of abortion, the widespread availability of birth control pills have certainly diminished the fear of pregnancy. There's been a relaxation of some taboos, and there's no question that more girls are engaging in sexual activity. And I do want to emphasize that I mean the whole range of activity, not just intercourse. I think that's very important to emphasize that in speaking about female sexuality, that we're not speaking just about intercourse. At any rate, more people are beginning their sexual lives younger than they did in the past. So the first point I want to make is how much things have changed. And the second point I want to make is how little things have changed. And here I'm turning really from what I've read, and partly to what's presented in the media, as well as just illustrating what I heard and what I've observed as a clinician, which leads me to think that in the privacy of our minds and hearts, things change much more slowly than they do in the media. And more slowly even than might be visible to an outside observer, someone who sees only behavior and doesn't know the meaning of that behavior, the subjective meaning of that behavior to the person that's engaging with. And here's where I want to talk about my clinical experience. I'm going to be speaking about heterosexuality, really because that's where I can speak from clinical experience. And I think it's an important setting of things right. But like many people in practice, I haven't seen as many lesbians as could lead me to speak really from a solid base of experience. And those who I've seen have tended to begin their sexual lives as lesbians later in life.
spent in religious sexuality. Even today, in 1995, we find it difficult to find words in which to talk about these differences, just as the girl herself in adolescence often has difficulty finding words for what she experiences. And I mean really talking about what she experiences, and we're all free to use dirty words, but I mean really talking about subjectively what she feels. And I think my own profession is partly to blame for this. The very terms that are widely used to describe the onset of puberty in both sexes are metaphors rooted in the sexual experience of males. It's customary in the psychological literature about early adolescence to read about the flood of impulses, the upsurge of drive, the maturation of spurt. The very metaphors used to describe the onset of puberty are drawn from the sexual experience of males, and they fail to accommodate the adolescent girl's very different experience of her emergent sexuality. Moreover, all their lives, boys have had the experience of having erections, visible,